I'm your host, Samaita Graver, and I want to welcome you to Truth, Salt, and Spice, the podcast, where you will find conversations steeped in biblical truths, sprinkled with salt, and a dash of spice thrown in, you know, for good measure. Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you today?
Wonderful.
I am too. I actually had a horrible headache yesterday and woke up with it again. I was driving around yesterday with my windows down, and I wonder if the pollen just did me in. I don't know.
You should try natural honey. Natural honey helps with the allergies and stuff. Local.
Yeah. I do like honey here and there, but I don't know. I would have to start drinking tea or something. Or do you just eat a spoonful or something a day?
you could put it on toast. It's so much easier to put it on toast with cream cheese.
I don't know if I like honey that much. But anyway, I've heard that it helps with allergies.
I'm a beekeeper, so I actually use it.
Oh, are you?
Yeah.
But I should actually, I've been actually, like, I dream about it often, and then I think, oh my gosh, it sounds so overwhelming, and it's expensive to start, isn't it?
No. You can easily catch bees in the wild.
Oh, really? Well, what about all the little boxes and stuff?
Yeah, about $200 a box. It's really nice
right.
Set up.
Well, then, you know, I need to talk. We'll have a whole other conversation about this some other time. Maybe there'll be some people that want to hear about beekeeping, but you know, that's not it. Oh my goodness. So how about you go ahead and introduce yourself? You can tell folks as little or as much as you want them to know about you, and we'll go from there.
Okay. My name's Kara Alberico. I'm the author of the book My Marriage to Recovery. And I'm a mother of four, grandmother of three. My husband and I, next month, will be married 21 years. And it's been a battle.
It's been a journey. Yes. We're going to dig right into that. And it's funny because you and I are part of a Facebook group, and, you know, there's so many women in there. I was just like, I don't know, you made a comment or posted something on something I said. I don't remember. I was just like, oh, this is a new name to me. And whenever somebody new and for me comes in, I always like to go check them out and, you know, see. And I saw that you had written a book, My Marriage to Recovery. And I was like, oh, that has got to be some of the hardest things to go through. So I am so grateful that you're willing to come in and talk about this. Because as I had told you, I had been in a relationship where my first husband was a drug addict and or in recovery. And let me tell you something, it is hard. Obviously, I said ex-husband, so we didn't make it through, but you're celebrating 21 years here. I want to hear all about it. So let's start with, like, when did you begin to suspect something was off? Like, what happened?
That's a really hard question, because at first, when you're in the situation, you don't see how smoking a joint in the other, you know, outside on your own, smoking a joint turns into something crashing. You don't see that coming. And I don't know if that's because you're in love with this person and you're blinded to it, or if you just don't want to see it. You don't want to see that happening to your loved one. You don't want to see that happening to him. You know, so it's a hard question to see. Now, looking back, I can tell you when I thought, you know, when I saw something wasn't right, is when the mortgage wasn't getting paid. And when, you know, he'd bring home groceries, you know, and he was making some pretty good money. And when you're making pretty good money and all that's coming home is groceries, you look at it and go, what's that? And then when money missing, it's like, what's that? He's got a really good job. This doesn't sound right. And when it really hit was when, because I didn't know the mortgage wasn't getting paid at first. You know, because I wasn't on the mortgage. It was just under his name. So they wouldn't talk to me. Wife or not, they wouldn't talk to me and tell me what was going on. So I did not know about the mortgage situation, but our power went out. I was pregnant and I had three other kids and I'm pregnant and the power's out. And he says he paid it. So I'm like, oh, well, let's get the receipt. That's not no problem. Let's get the receipt. And then, you know, I'm searching through the car for the receipt and I found a crack rock.
You found what? I'm sorry?
I found a crack rock.
Yeah.
Rock a crack. And I'm like, oh, no, this can't be what I think it is. You know, throw it away, you know, and not thinking, well, he went ballistic when he got home. He's like, you know, something was in my car and, you know, where is it now?
Yeah.
I mean, he's freaking out. It's not that. He's not, you know, mad at me. He's not throwing, you know, mad at me. But he was really upset that it was gone. And that point right there, I was like, okay.
So how did you know?
Like, now
were you familiar with drugs that you knew that was a crack rock? Like, what was?
I'm a hippie kid.
You were what?
I'm a hippie kid. My parents were hippies. So we knew about, you know, a white cross, which is now speed, of some kind of speed. And stuff from their time. So I kept myself educated on everything else. So I could teach my kids. So I keep my kids from that. You know, I taught them as much as I possibly could, even though their father smoked pot.
Yeah.
You know, and they knew everything. They knew what it smelled like. They knew what to stay away from. They knew the effects it has on your body. I made sure my kids were extremely educated.
Do you think that having been a hippie kid gave you or allowed for you to have a certain amount of tolerance for the smoking that you wouldn't have otherwise? I'm not.
The tolerance for smoking pot, definitely. Yeah. Definitely. I can handle smoking pot more than I can handle smoking cigarettes. And I don't know if that's just because of how I was raised or that I have, like you said, maybe more of a tolerance to that. And,
now,
I think
did
so.
You yourself smoke as well? Okay.
No, I didn't, but I'm the only one of six kids that didn't.
Interesting. On something that's totally acceptable,
I'm the
right?
oldest.
And then,
It was totally acceptable in our home. Yeah. And my father actually offered me a joint when I was 13, allowing me to go ahead and open those doors at home, not going out in public. But I was the oldest, so I saw when my parents got, like, trashed. And I'm, you know, 6 years old trying to feed my three other siblings, you know? So when I'm looking at it, I'm going, I don't want to be that.
So that protected you. Yes, I
you know?
See that.
Mm-hmm. Right. Now, that didn't happen our whole lives. That was just the early stages of our life. But it was enough for me to see what I don't want to be.
Interesting. Yeah.
And now, in my side of the family, too, there's no history of addiction. So when it came to addiction, I wasn't prepared. I wasn't prepared.
So how
at
do
all.
You differentiate that?
Yeah, my parents.
Like, your parents smoking pot, but they weren't addicted to it. And then, like, what's the distinction there for you?
The distinction is simple. They could put it down anytime they wanted to, and they did. You know, they did once. We started getting a little bit older and it started to get, you know, hairy about who says what at school, you know, they put it away, made it more private, didn't do as much, but in an addiction, the mind changes gears. There's no longer a what if on the consequences. It's a need. It's a drive. It's no longer just a craving. It's, I have to have this. It does not matter if I get this and I don't have rent. If I get this and I could lose my wife and family. It doesn't, that part of the brain doesn't work anymore.
So let me back.
Part of the
ahead,
brain.
Finish that thought.
Okay. I was.
Just a part of the brain. Okay. I wasn't sure. So I want to go back a little bit because you were talking about we wanted to make sure that your children didn't go through all this. So here you are in the middle of it. Like, how did you feel toward yourself? Was there amount of guilt or shame, or like, what were you telling yourself when you woke up and you're like, oh my gosh, like, this is not the life that I didn't want this. And here I am.
Oh gosh. You go into survival mode. You know, everything doesn't, you don't think about the life you have. You think about, how can I fix this? How can I fix him? Mm-hmm. How can I fix, hold on, we don't have rent this month. So how do I get rent? What do we do to get rent? Okay, so, oh, wait, okay, we have rent. We don't have groceries. All right, well, da-da-da-da-da. Mm-hmm. You know, you go into survival mode. Everything is about fixing him. Oh, he's sleeping in, and I got to call his boss and let him know that he's sick and he's not okay. You know, and, oh, wait. All right, there's no gas in the car. We got to find out how to get gas in the car. No. Everything is in survival mode. You don't think anymore about the life you're living. You're just living it. And you're not really living it. You're just surviving.
And then enabling the behavior,
and yes,
right?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Definitely enabling the behavior. And you don't realize you're doing that. You're just thinking that you're saving your family. And family comes first, and it's important that we make sure the kids are safe and they're they're fed and they've got a roof over their head and all of that, and you try to protect them from their dad, you know.
Yeah.
I never had to deal with violence from him ever. Let me make that clear. He had never hit me, and if that was the case, or he ever hit the kids, I don't know if I'd be here talking to you about marriage through recovery.
Yeah.
So we never had that issue of violence. There was a lot of verbal abuse for a while there. But it wasn't ever violent. And yes, there's some circumstances that I regret. Yeah. Because I didn't know. I wasn't at this point where I could see what addiction was. And I was always about, well, it's willpower and, you know, it's a choice. And yes, there are choices made, but it's also a disease. There are things in the brain that are happening that are screwed up for life. You know, so now they're dealing with this for the rest of their life.
It changes, so, right? I don't know what the medical term, I'm thinking of neural pathways or something. It's
yes, you're exactly right. It changes the pleasure pathways in your brain. The dopamine, which is like the happy messenger in your brain, it helps you be happy. It helps you find pleasure. This is what happens when you eat chocolate.
Yeah.
You know, you get this dopamine in your brain. And this is what happens when you laugh and when you eat your favorite foods. This dopamine comes into your system and you're having fun. You're having pleasure. Well, what crack cocaine or meth or any of the stimulants do is they overact that dopamine. They pretty much overdose on the dopamine and they're super happy. But then after they do that for a while, their brain no longer produces its own dopamine. So they can't get happy. They can't find pleasure in anything but drug. So this is a system that now they're trying to find a way to get happy, but the only way they know how is, oh, wait, this drug makes me happy.
Yeah, I know exactly. Fortunately, I've been, in that too. So we have you trying to, this attitude of fixing him, making excuses, the enabling. Where are you in your spiritual walk at this point? Like, where does
God, in the enabling
where does God come in where you're in the middle of this, like right here still? You haven't moved on to something has to change. Now you're just trying to keep all the eggs up, you know, from juggling all the eggs so they don't fall and break. You know?
Honestly, I guess most of the time I'm blaming God.
Okay.
At this point, I'm telling him, you know, I guess you don't care about me anymore. You don't care this is all happening. So I'm just going to take care of it myself. I'm going to make this work. And, you know, I love you. You know, I love you, God. But, you know, I can't trust you. Look, he's still relapsing. I mean, he's in recovery. And he's still relapsing. He's still doing this. He's still doing that. You know, where is my trust in you? If I'm supposed to have this abundant life, what kind of abundant life am I having? You know, if I have to scrounge for food, you know, if I have to scrounge for the light bill, you know, I at that point in time, I would still pray to him. But most of my prayers were, why? Why are you doing this to me? Why am I in this situation? Why am I so hurt constantly? Why do I have to survive like this?
Yeah. At what point did you get to the when did you get to the point of realizing that, unfortunately, because sin is sin and people are going to do what they're going to do, right? That he wasn't doing this to you. Unfortunately, this was your husband's walk, and being married to him, you were the, you know, the victim along the way.
Oh, wow. That one's a hard one. I guess what I could say is I started an Al-Anon group.
Okay.
I went to this group thinking that they're going to teach me how to fix him. And it was not what I thought. I mean, I started going to this group. And for those that don't know what Al-Anon is, this is a support group for loved ones of addicts, like mothers and wives and everything like that. And so I started going to this group, and the first thing they taught me is you can't cure it, you can't control it, and you didn't cause it. And when that happened, when they were saying that, it made me shift a gear here and there, thinking, you know, if I can't cure it, then why am I calling his boss when he's, you know, sick after night of smoking crack?
Right. How do you and go from I have to call because if he gets fired, we're already struggling, how are we going to survive, to I can't fix this, so you handed them back to him, right, the responsibility?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Definitely. But mm-hmm. it really took time. I started doing the 12 steps myself, which I highly recommend to everyone. Because the 12 steps walks you closer and closer to Christ and trust in Christ and helps you understand what your part of this is. And it wasn't people telling me, oh, well, you're an enabler. Oh, you're an enabler. You just need to leave. You hear that all the time, all the time. But that does not help your addict. That does not help your addict at all. They already kill themselves with the guilt of what they do. They already kill themselves. When they're in recovery, it makes it worse. If they relapse in recovery, mm-hmm. they are devastated. This is something that they just don't understand. Why am I still doing this? I have a sponsor. I have meetings. I have this. Why am I still doing this? I have God. And it to come home after a fall or after a slip and to be totally devastated by your spouse, it doesn't make it any better.
Yeah.
It does not make it any better. And the part about the 12 steps for the spouse is to learn where you stand and why you react the way you do when he relapses. because that relapse to you is a total rip out your heart because I was trusting you again. And you take the money and you go.
Yeah. Well, fear. I mean, when you've already lived with it for a while, you're just like, I can't do that. Now I will tell you, and I know you know this, that this is like when these relapses happen, and I know that I don't know how many your husband has gone through, whatnot, and you know, you've stood there by his side, but you know, what made you say, I'm going to stick this out, as opposed to, okay, this is it, I'm gone, which you would have been okay to do as well. So what was that for you?
I could see past it. I could still see my husband in there. And I couldn't, it was like he was wearing a mask. And every once in a while, I could see the man I married, that wonderful, loving person that I married. And I went through a bad divorce. I was controlled. It was a very controlling situation. And when I got out of it, I had no idea who I was. You know, I had no idea. And Ralph stepped in and helped me through that. Helped me become the person I am. Helped me learn who I am. He walked me through that. And he basically saved my life. There's another whole story about the saved life thing. He actually saved my life. But in this situation, and mentally, he saved my life. And I could not see myself looking at this man who saved me. Who am I to walk away when he's sick? Who am I to walk away when he's hurting? When his mind isn't where it needs to be? When he's lost who he is. And I couldn't
leave. Yeah. So let me ask you this. Did you have clear what would need to happen for you to be like, what boundary would he have needed to cross for you to be like, no, that this is not okay and we need to be done? Were you clear on that? Like once you started going through, like, you know, Al-Anon and all that?
Oh, no. Al-Anon, and it teaches you you need boundaries, but it doesn't teach you how to create them and where they need to be. That's a personal issue. That's something that you have to walk through on your own, that you have to work out on your own. And it's a living thing, boundaries. It's not something, the way I see it, it's like a garden. Okay, you've got this garden and you got these bricks all around your garden. And this garden's growing and it's beautiful and there's flowers and everything. And you've got this boundary, which is the concrete blocks, right? But your flowers kind of hang over the side of the blocks. And you have to choose how far these flowers are going to go over this boundary. But you want the flowers. They're beautiful, right? So you want to keep the flowers. You don't want to cut them off, but they're beautiful, but they're still kind of hanging over the boundary. So you choose to move the boundary a bit. That's okay. It's okay to move your boundary a bit. It's not okay for them to break it down. You need to stand firm in your boundaries and see what boundaries can be played with and what ones can't. Physical pain was one of my boundaries. You don't hurt me. You don't hurt my kids.
Okay.
And if there was no boundary there, one time you hurt me or my kids, I'm gone. You know, and that was, that was mine.
That was yours. Okay.
Now that's not to say that if it happened and I left, and he was in recovery and he was recovering, if I wouldn't from afar stay and watch to see what happens in his life, if it's worth
Yeah, reconciling. Yeah, that's basically was mine too, interesting enough. Because I remember one time, at this point, I think my ex-husband had been clean, but he had picked up then drinking. So, it's one drug for another. He came home inebriated, and I didn't know what bug was up his behind, but I was watching. I remember clearly. It's funny how you remember certain things very clearly. And I'm not one that lives most in the past, but I was watching actually Miss Universe. I don't know. I was sitting at home, the kids were in bed, and he comes in, and I'm like, and then he just starts being ridiculous, standing in front of the TV, blocking it. And I just decide I'm going to go to bed because I'm not interacting with a drunk person. And then he started pushing me around, and I was like, that was it. His bags were packed the next day, and I said, "You need to go because I will not be a statistic. You will be dead," is what I told him. Because I will kill you if you ever hit me. Like, that's just not even gonna, And that was just the end of it, really. And years later, we ended up divorced, but that was it. So I definitely had a clear, like, nope, we're done here. And there was no looking from afar or anything like that. Because that was definitely where I was clear of, just like, you touch me, by Felicia, it's just not happening. So I get that. However, looking back, that was just the extreme. I could have benefited from healthier boundaries and different things much earlier on, for sure. But I was working, and I've always been a try to be debt-free kind of person. I that just is not worth the stress. I prefer to eat beans and rice than to have debt. So there, I didn't really struggle a whole much when we were together. Ironically, I struggled then when we got divorced, and when I was a single mom, because things didn't, stretch a whole lot, and that was a really difficult time after that, for a while. But not economically during that time. It was just basically, and I think you probably can relate to this. Even though you're married and you have somebody there, it's so lonely. Like, it's a lonely relationship because you're just not, there's no connection. It all revolves around the drugs. Like, the person cannot be present there as a companion for you.
That's one of my regrets, is that I pushed everybody away. On my family, my friends, I pushed everybody away because I didn't want them to know my dirty little secret. Of course, everybody knew, but I didn't want anybody to know. I wanted it all to myself because I didn't want anybody to struggle or have any problems with dealing with me. I didn't go to my family for money. I didn't do anything like that. So nobody knew what was going on in my life. Now that he's in recovery and he's open and out there about it, and we go to family reunions and he talks about it, and they're like, my side of the family, they don't know about addiction. They don't understand all that. They know a little bit here and there about, drug use and some drinking, but they don't know anything about addiction itself. So he tells them about it, and they're just like, but they're understanding more. He's opening doors that they didn't know before. They're ex understanding more and going out. But I mean, I hid my family from my kids, so now my kids aren't associated with my side of the family at all, because they don't, my side of the family weren't there because I pushed them away. And I regret that because now I don't have that connection with them to tell them stories about their family, my side of the family, with them having any knowledge of who they are. They know them. They know who they are. They know where they are.
But then,
But no connection. It's lonely. It's very, very lonely.
are your children adult now? Adults, or are they just older
I've got
children?
three adult children, and
Okay.
two have their own kids. And I have one still at home. She's 15.
Okay.
Perfect child. But all my kids had their own perfections, Each of them had their own way of making life easier through this addiction. And it was awesome. And I hated how they missed out on a lot of stuff, but they have grown up with such compassion for addicts and understanding. And they are so close to their dad. We only got one that's not really close to their dad. And it's nice. It's nice to see that even through all of this, they can love and care on and be part of their dad's life.
So I was going to ask you that, how they have responded or reacted to you sticking it through. So you said one is not close. Is that the oldest?
No, that's my oldest girl.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
That's my oldest girl. And she's far away. She mm-hmm. moved to Seattle, Washington, mm-hmm. and I live in Texas. She went as far as she possibly could.
So is it because of what happened, like her experience is what has her?
I think some of it is. I think that's why she moved so far away, is because it's happening. Mm-hmm. I think the others are closer to their father because they're seeing now his recovery. They're seeing what he's going through now and how well he's doing now. And there's his mm-hmm. growth in Christ and everything else that they can adjust, and they can ask him questions. He's open to answer any questions they ask about addiction.
But so they've been able to experience the repentance firsthand, and she has not.
Exactly.
The other one that moved. Yeah. Okay. I see the difference. So what happened in his life that led him from, because there are many people out there that smoke pot left and right all their lives. They're not, you know, addicts to the harder core stuff. They live a normal, you know, whatever, semi-functioning life. I don't know, whatever that that would be. What happened to him that he went then deeper and deeper to where he ended up at?
I think he's still trying to find that out. I think he's still hunting for that answer because he doesn't know right now. Or he either doesn't know right now or he's not comfortable in telling me just yet. Does that make sense?
Gotcha.
It's still, recovery is a process, and it's something that you have, it's soul searching, you know? And parts of it he shares with me, which I'm fully blessed how much he shares with me. But parts of it has to be private. It has to be his own. I think that's the hardest part for me, is that I want to be all in, you know, and I can't be. I can't be for his recovery. I can't be for him to grow the way he needs to grow. Some of this stuff needs to be private. And I don't like it.
Now, how do you deal with, like, the trust thing? Because I remember when my ex-husband, you know, got clean and he went to rehab and whatnot, I don't think eventually it would have worked. Now, did he? I can't remember. This is so many years ago. I don't think he did Al-Anon or anything. I definitely didn't go. But I just remember, like, oh, I'm going to go to the store to buy cigarettes or whatever, right? And then the store's like 5 minutes away, half an hour, he's not back. I'm already like, oh my gosh, he's strung out. He went back to drugs. Oh, like, you know.
Yes, yes.
And then it's just like, where were you? What are you doing? It's like, well, I ran to so-and-so and we were talking for a couple extra minutes, you know. I just eventually, even if he never touched anything again, I don't think it would have worked because I couldn't deal with knowing that, you know, because of all the lies, they're constantly lying. They're constantly lying and manipulating. And I just couldn't deal with the stress of that. Like, it was just, I can't deal with this. And it wasn't fair necessarily, you know, to the other person, but, you know, how have you dealt with that? Or how do you keep that in check?
Prayer, a lot of it. At first, you know, it was very, very difficult. And, let me tell you a situation that changed my perspective completely. He was in jail again, you know, and he was in there for 4 months. And of course, in there, I mean, you can get drugs if you want, but in there, he was sober. So I'm like, hey, yeah, 4 months. All right. And he's, you know, 2 weeks from getting out. And I'm a school bus driver. So I'm sitting on my bus in the morning, no kids on the bus. This is when I have my real me and God time. And I am begging God. I'm like, Lord God, how do I trust him? How do I trust him again? This is over and over. How do I trust him? And it was just like constant asking him that. And it was a voice that just completely boomed through my head. You don't trust him, you trust me.
Oh, that's
so
good.
I'm whoa, I am bawling in tears. I am crushed but relieved. Does that make sense? It was like a total rush that I couldn't control. I was so overwhelmed with what he was telling me. And parts of me was like, how can I trust you? He's been relapsing. I've been going through all of this stuff. How can I trust you to take care of me? And that was another struggle. But the thing is that trusting God was why we weren't dead from it. You know? I was trying to do everything on my own. If I'm trusting God to do it for me, this would not be as bad as it was. Because I would not be the enabler. I would not be scientifically.
So looking back, where do you see God at work clearly? Like, this is what he was doing while I was too busy, like not trusting. I couldn't see what he was at work. Do you have like
that would be a whole nother podcast.
How about one?
It was near Christmas. The power was out. I had a 6-month-old baby that had fallen off a table and broke her left femur. And I'm sitting in the living room. We are cold. We have food. We have food stamps and we have, WIC. So we have food. I'm crying because I broke my baby. We have no electricity. And I'm just like, okay, God, I trust you. What I trust you to be here for us. Christmas is right around the corner. We're just going to do Christmas. You're going to fix all this. And it's the first time in this fight that I completely released everything. Not saying that I didn't grab some of it back. Don't get me wrong. But I completely...
I
left it. I finally just went... Then there was a knock on the door. We went to the door. And it was this church, this pastor from a church that we've never been to. And he says, we've got something for you for Christmas. And they pull us all out of the house. And we're all... And they said, we want to pray for you. And there's like 20 of them that came. And they're praying over us. And I'm just filling with love right now. Not even thinking anything about the power. Mm-hmm. Just feeling love right now. And I'm like, oh, this is great. And they bring me a check. I said, this is for Christmas. And they gave me this check, and I can remember exactly, it was $249.23, this check. And I fell to my knees, and I bawled, and they didn't understand, but that is the exact amount that I needed for my lights. To the penny. Wow. Exactly the amount I needed for my lights. Now, not every situation was that perfect, okay? That I could see God just
totally in that. But I do see moments of, now looking back, I ask my kids, what is their favorite memories about growing up? And I'm scared when I ask that, because I thought, you know, they'd say, I don't have any. Or, you know, it was horrible. My whole childhood was horrible. But their favorite memories were when the power was out and we played cards. Or we did, we play hide and seek in the dark, where they would run around and play hide and seek, and they'd hide, and we, you know, power's out, so we really can't turn the lights on to find them. So we're, you know, reaching in the dark to find each of the kids. And it, they remember these horrible moments as good memories. And that was God. That was God. Because he was, well, yeah, he was in it. He was in every moment of it. And now that I'm looking back, today is actually my husband's S day, sobriety date. And we call it our S day instead of a birthday. We call it our S day. And I, we celebrate. Even.
So what does that mean? Sobriety day, like the first time that he, what, like last time yes. he used, or
it's his, what? his very first okay. clean day we celebrate. And it doesn't matter.
Okay. So how long has it been?
Honestly, then? 2 months. But it doesn't matter how many times you relapse. It doesn't matter how bad the slip or the fall. We celebrate that date. We go out and eat. Well, we can't right now, but we'll go yeah. out and pick up some takeout and bring it home, watch a movie. We celebrate his S day, no matter how long it's been, no matter if it's been 1 month, no matter if it's been 2 years, no matter if it was.
What's the longest 2.5 years has he gone clean?
2.5 years.
So let me ask you this. So when relapse happens, are you at a point where he just comes and confesses, or do you have to, like, do you end up finding out because he starts behaving weird, or
it depends on if it's a slip or a fall? A slip, he'll come back and he'll talk to me. Wait, do you understand the difference between a slip and a fall?
Well, okay, I'm gonna guess. To me, a slip is a one-time thing. Come back, a fall is like gone down the deep end. I don't know.
Okay, yes, that's pretty much it. A slip, yeah. They come back. They're like, I don't know why I did this. You know, da-da-da-da-da. They repent, and they're back on the right track immediately. A fall is more, they get in that whirlpool of guilt. And they keep using and keep using, and it takes a lot more to get them out of that. And that right there is where my trust has issues. And like you said, there's, you see yeah. red flags. And right now, my husband deals with a lot of police pulling him over. Because he has a history, because he's been in jail, because he has a felony for holding, you know, holding crack cocaine, which no, there's no minimum amount that
yeah.
it's a felony to have that in possession. So he has a felony. Yeah. So he gets pulled over a lot. We have a police officer that in our area that just, when I say a lot, I mean like twice a month, twice to three times a month. And he has to actually show me that the cop is behind him and take a picture of the cop vehicle behind him while he's being pulled over. So I know that that's true, that he's not just out using and using police pulling mm-hmm. him over as a crutch. And he shouldn't have to do that.
Yeah.
I should be in a place where I trust God, that if he's using, that God works through his life to work that out. And I have my own bank account. I don't rely on his income to pay my bills anymore. So I don't allow the financial burden of his fall or slip to affect me anymore. And that's a big that's a big deal, you know, to separate that, because the falls will happen, the slips will happen. And recovery, relapse is part of recovery. And there's no way around that. They have to learn by their mistakes. And and every time they relapse, there is a new mistake that they're learning. There's something new that they're learning about themselves that's a trigger to relapse. Eventually.
I will also say that when it comes to trust, you know, trust is built by showing up consistently the same, you know, in a positive way. And so while I understand your concept of, you know, I shouldn't have this, you know, he shouldn't have to prove that he got pulled over, whatever, whatnot, that's the burden on him because of the consequences of his actions. I personally, I mean, and this is maybe one of these, you know, disagree that we can disagree. I actually see it as being wise, because it still shows you got work to do. And I think eventually, you know, I'm hoping, like, for him that this 2 month thing that he's on, that it's done.
Me
like,
too.
You know, I wish that for him. And so, you know, so if he's on this thing and you reach 2 years, 3 years, 10 years, 15 years, I know that eventually our trust will be built and that kind of stuff will be less. But, you know, it's one of these things that I, you know, I hear I'm giving you unsolicited advice. It's
no, okay to I totally agree with what you're saying. No, it's not the accountability that I was saying he didn't need to be doing. It's for me, for my comfort.
Oh, okay.
His accountability is awesome. We want that. We want them to hold themselves accountable for what's going on. But I shouldn't have to ask for it. I shouldn't be in a place in my own recovery to need that. I should be fully confident in the Lord that whatever's happening in his life, God's got him. You know? It's not that I should not need this accountability to be okay. I should be okay even if he is using. That's his problem. That is his recovery. That is between him and God. So, yes.
Okay, so it's a heart thing.
Exactly.
For you.
Yeah.
It's not the account. Okay. So, you're looking for, in this accountability, it is still anchoring you and giving you
exactly
hope, as
exactly
to still focusing on God. Is that what you're saying?
I shouldn't need
okay.
that.
Okay, I got you. So you're okay with accountability, but you don't, in your heart,
exactly,
you don't want to depend on
thank
that.
Thank you. You got it.
All right. Okay, we're good. Gotcha. I see what you're saying. So yes, accountability, it's needed. It's good for them. You just don't want to find peace in that. You still want to focus on God, whether he's using or not, that your peace comes from God.
Right. One of the hardest things for me through this recovery process is putting my husband first in this marriage, making him the leader of the home. That has been a immense struggle in recovery and all of that. I mean, I will not allow him to do things that are against God to lead our family. But to honor him the way we're supposed to biblically, I still struggle hard. Mm-hmm. I want to take over. Yeah.
Well, you know, that makes sense. And it makes sense because in a healthy marriage, then you have this, you know, companionship, teamwork, whatever. But when he's not keeping his vows, then, you know, it's kind of like, well, we got to do what we got to do here. So, you know, it is unfortunate that the marriage doesn't look like what God would have wanted it, you know, to be in a, you know, in a healthy sense. I mean, no marriage is perfect. Right. We all go through stuff, whether there's addiction or not. But, you know, I'm here thinking, for even for other women that may be in this, they can't, or the husband, if he's in the throes of recovery and still trying to figure things out, it's like asking a toddler to start walking when they still
exactly
trying to master crawling. And I think it is totally okay to be, you know what, this is, I'm the stable one here and I'm going to be the leader, and we can co-lead as much as you can handle. And I think that's wise if
right.
people are going to decide to stick it out, you know. So when you have a you know, co-leadership, even in a healthy situation, we all come in with different strengths. And to just label something, you know, man, no. woman, I don't think is beneficial in general for a marriage. But when it comes to recovery, I would think that, I mean, all bets are off. We're creating something new here with God at the center.
Right.
We've got to figure out what we're going to do here with who's leading what. And lead him, you know, give him, empower him to do what he can do. So, you know, if you're really good, I don't know, I'm pulling something out of thin air. You know, if you're really good at balancing the checkbook, even if he may not be in charge of the money directly, let's say of the bank account, but math is his thing, then here, give him all the receipts and saying, what's the budget? What can we do or not? You know, it's not about cutting them off and making them feel like they're subhuman or trash, but you got to give them something to definitely know that they are part of the equation.
Exactly. And it,
but,
it's,
you know, only what they can
definitely
handle.
A testing ground. You have to, you know, play with what they can handle and what they can't. Because, you know, they really, they're the really the only ones that know. And being the outsider looking in, you're like, And that situation is perfect. I do the bills, I pay all the bills, and he does the budget. And it does work out very good that way. And he handles negotiations. Yes, we actually do that.
Oh, you guys actually do that?
We actually do that.
He
handles all the negotiation stuff that has to be sorted out. And I make all the arrangements. We have a sign on our door that says, do you want to speak to the man in charge or the woman that knows what's going on? Because he'll make the plan. He won't make the plan. He says, I want to do this. And I'm like, okay, well, you stand back, I will get it done. You know, and that's how our marriage is working at this point. You know, I will tell him, I would like to see this happen. And this is part of the negotiation, so this is your job. I'll take care of the rest of it. You do this. And I give him one task that it's like, okay, this is part of what you want done. This is your task. You do this, you know, and it works that way. And, you know, my father-in-law always goes to him and says, okay, what's this and this and this? And he goes, oh, well, here's.
So how difficult is it, you know, in being married and having to deal with your husband, in essence, acting like a child because nobody wants to be mothering their husband? How have you dealt with that?
Well, and going to school, I've learned that there's actual scientific proof that the brain stops developing when they start using full time. So you're looking at, say, a 15-year-old that's using drugs on a regular basis. Their brain stops maturing. And it doesn't start maturing until they stop using drugs. So when your spouse is in recovery and, say, they're this 15-year-old, when they stop, they're still the 15-year-old. They still have to develop from the age of 15 and grow like everybody else. And dealing with three teenagers in the home and a 15-year-old, another teenager, it was hard. It's hard to sit there and know that you have to put consequences to actions. And it's a whole nother kind of animal because you're dealing with an adult that acting like is the ultimate deal with that. He consequences to the actions. He's got to deal with him. And it took me a long time to say, okay, Lord, he's yours. He's your child, not mine. He's my husband, your child.
Yeah.
There you go. You take over. I can't do it. I have to raise three teenagers. I can't raise an adult child. And it took a lot. It took a lot to get to that point where I'm just like, okay, Lord, he's yours. Now, situation like this 15-year-old adult to play video games instead of getting a job. He's sitting there, no job. Well, you know, I'll just play video games. We've got all the bills to sit here and play video games. I don't want a job. And you're like, but you're a grown man. You need to go get a job. You need to help me pay bills. And in your heart, you're dying because you're thinking, I shouldn't have to raise this child. He's been raised. He's an adult. So you back off and you say, okay, Lord, take over. I can't make him get up and get a job. I can't ground him.
Yeah.
You know, I can't do any. And your teenagers that are actual teenagers see this. And it's really hard to explain to them that that's not the way you see your life. Now, that situation did not happen in my life. My husband has a very strong work ethic. He was all about paying for his own drugs. He's a very strong work ethic. He always worked. And, you know, he had his layovers where he had a few months of not working because he got busted using and got fired. And then there was long stages of not working. But he always was looking. So it was never about his work ethic. But that was just an example of how different teenage actions that you have to deal with as they're growing in recovery. They're sober, but they're acting like a child. And it's difficult. It's difficult. But trusting the Lord to raise him and not you to raise him does take a very huge pressure off your heart.
Now, you mentioned that you're learning in school. So you want to tell us a little bit about what you're studying and what you want to do?
Yeah, I'm in college right now to get a bachelor's degree in criminal justice with human services. I chose that field because I want to open a rehab center for families of addicts to where they live on property. They get psychiatric care without having to pay for it. They get growing processes, life skills, a moderate rent, you know. So we're the people that have addicts going into recovery, they don't get any help. They really don't. The wives, the children, they don't have any help. When I was looking for help, there wasn't anything out there. Yes, there's Al-Anon, but Al-Anon, most of them don't have childcare. Most of them are at a time and a place where you can't just drop off your kids somewhere else and go to a meeting. It's not like AA. It's not like, you know, these guys that can just go to any meeting. There's like 20 of them in your area all times of the night. There's not, Al-Anon's not like that. For me, I have to travel 30 minutes to the nearest Al-Anon meeting, and it's at noon during the week. You know, when I'm working. So these kind of things, they don't happen. You know, children of addicts and wives of addicts, they need psychiatric care. I'm not saying they're mentally ill. And some of them are. This does include that, but they need help. to get out of the situation, the mindset that they've been put in with their addicts. The children, they're warped because the mom is taking so much time to fix the husband that sometimes they don't get any care. They're left to fend for themselves. And these psychiatric care is expensive. And if you're dealing with the fact that your husband's in jail or in recovery and you have no income, that's hard.
Yeah.
It's really hard. So there needs to be a place where these people can go and say, hey, how do I do this? You did this. How do I do this? And can you help me? That's what we want to do, my husband and I. We want to help these people. We want to help these women and children, these families that are willing to stick with their husband, but they're dealing with so much they just can't.
Yeah, it is. It is hard. And it's a very lonely road.
Yeah.
Or can be, anyway. And especially there for women that choose to stay and work it out. I think a lot of times people determine that then you're on your own because, you know, they decide that whether they're right or not, that if they stay with their spouse, that they're, you know, they're on their own. And, you know, it's really hard because when I think sometimes of women that stay in abuse and a lot of people eventually just give up on them and, you know, move on because they won't leave. And I think with addiction, I think the same thing happens a lot. People get impatient and then just, you know, move on. Friendships and relationships get, you know, destroyed because of that. And I think we need to respect the choices that other people make and still, you know, find ways to support them. But I like that since you've been through this road that you can be able to support them, but still be without judgment, and then, you know, allow them to work it out in a smart way that they're not enabling.
Yeah.
I think that would probably do well.
Yeah, definitely. The worst thing to ever tell a woman in that situation is, why don't you just leave them? That's the worst thing to ever tell a woman in that situation, because they're going to sit there and they're going to think you're judging them for their choices. I don't judge anybody that has decided to leave their husband. I don't judge that at all. That is their decision and where they were willing to adjust and need to be. You know,
mm-hmm.
Just as I was able to do this, doesn't mean everybody should and doesn't mean everybody can. Everybody's situation is different. Everybody's relationship with Christ is different. Everybody's relationship with their judge every situation on what you've gone through. But to sit there and be there for somebody to make sure that they know they're not alone in this, even if they decide to leave, that kind of baggage is horrible. And so they need people. But in that situation, you decide to leave. You don't know who to trust, who's not going to judge you.
Yeah. It is. It's definitely, definitely hard. Because I remember I made a choice to stay for as long as I did. But I knew that people see that as weakness. And actually, to be honest, I have been judgmental myself. And not in that aspect, but I always wonder about women that got, you know, that stayed in abusive relationships. I never understood it. And I still don't understand it because I am not one, like, physically abusive, like, to one, like, it's my personality.
Yeah.
But the other thing is, or women that have, their spouse has been has cheated on them. I was trying to look for another more classy word, but I couldn't think of it. Has committed adultery. That's the word I was looking for. You know, and I always was just like, oh my gosh, what is wrong with you? Whatever, you know. But I wasn't a Christian then, and I you know, Christ, God is in the business of reparation and reconciliation, and He wants us to have whole marriages and whatnot. And so, you know, for a woman that decides to forgive that and stay with a repentant husband, I admire it now, because frankly, where I saw it as weakness, now I see that they are much stronger than I am, because even at this point, I'm like, gosh, I don't know if I could do that. But I say that with humility, not with judgment now. And so, you know, when I look at women decide to, like you, you're walking it out, you know, with your husband and you're still there, I just think, wow, I know I couldn't, and I didn't. It just didn't last. Mm-hmm. And so I see where you're coming from, and I see the stance that you've taken spiritually, and I see it and I admire that. But it's okay if other women have not, and I don't think it devalues them leaving, because like you said, each situation is most definitely different, and we have to do what we feel ultimately is best for ourselves and for our children. But I'm glad that you're looking to the future and providing a service for people that are going to need the emotional and economical help to be able to move forward, whether they stay with their husbands or not. Or is it just for women, or is it going to be spouses? Because I know it's the other way around too. There are women that are addicts, obviously.
Because been equipped to handle the other side of that coin. So this is something that I've been seriously in prayer about, and I do have time to maneuver whatever options I have and that aspect to grow closer to knowing if I'm going to handle male spouses or not.
Gotcha.
I don't know. I don't know right now.
So we've got to the point where I ask my guest, how are you being salt in your neck of the woods?
How am I being salt? Yes. Right now, I am working with my church to have a kind of Christ-based Al-Anon group at our church, trying to open some more avenues to talk to people. I'm editing my book, because when I wrote the book, I hadn't started school, so there's a lot of new stuff that I want to, you know, new information to put into play. That I want to start on. I don't really know how God is the salt shaker, and I haven't had a clue of what He's doing with me right now.
That's okay. Sometimes we're in seasons of transition. Oh my goodness. And so the final question then is, if you were a spice, what would it be, and how do you bring that to the table?
Okay, so this starts with something my pastor said. Clint Paschal, he mentioned the fact that, you know, spices are put together for a reason. You wouldn't take a cinnamon and just eat cinnamon. That you would mix it with all these other spices to make something beautiful and golden in your oven, you know? And I see myself as that cinnamon, that if I was left to myself and by myself, that I would be bitter, and I would smell good, but I'd be bitter and nasty to the taste. But when you mix me with my husband, with my kids, with my church family, with others that are struggling like I am, and you mix me together with all of those different ingredients in my life, God has created this beautiful cinnamon bun sitting in the oven. And step I make, I don't see it while I'm making the step, but once I make that step and look back, I'm like, ooh, that smells good. No matter how bad it looks, you know, it works. So I would say I am that cinnamon.
I like that analogy.
So without God, that has a lot to do with my pastor bringing the analogy, but yeah, if you were to pick any spice, it would be cinnamon.
That's awesome. Mm-hmm. Well, Kara, thank you so much for taking time to share your story with us, and I will most definitely be seeing you around.
All right. Thank you. And thank you for inviting me on to the show.
Yes. See, it wasn't that bad, was it? Oh, no. I actually view my guests as a bit of heroes and very courageous because, you know, you're putting yourself out there to listen to whomever, you know, would come on. And you know, it's a risk. It's a risk. But I love that you're sharing God's truth so that you inspire other people to not be stuck. So, all right. Well, you have a good one, and I will talk to you later.
All right. Bye-bye.